The Big Story is brought to you by Scotia iTrade. There's a trader in all of us. Canada's largest city has a problem. And if you live in Toronto, or even if you've ever considered moving to the city, or you know somebody who does or has, you know what that problem is. And if you just say it's the housing market, you're sort of right. But as hard as it is to purchase a home in Toronto right now, it might be even harder to rent. A lack of affordable housing isn't an issue unique to Toronto, but it's worse here than anywhere else in Canada. And when people can't find a place to live, people end up on the streets. And when people end up on the streets, that means the city has failed them. So how does a vacancy rate end up at historic lows? What happens when hundreds or even thousands of people are competing for a few scraps of affordable housing? What happens to the regulations around rental units when demand is higher than anyone could have anticipated when they were written? And what does it look like on the ground right now to someone trying to just find a place to live in this city? I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings, and this is The Big Story. We have two guests for you today. Tamara Kandacker is a Vice reporter who will give us a firsthand look at the would-be tenant's experience from the ground up trying to find housing.
As soon as a posting goes up, the number of responses that it gets is crazy.
And Emily Matthew is the Toronto Star's affordable housing reporter.
I think that our pipeline is deeply broken. I don't think we have enough of enough types of housing to make sure that everyone gets to live in this city.
So we'll start with her. This issue is pressing enough that it is a full-time beat at that newspaper. So Emily, how bad is it in Toronto right now?
dire probably wouldn't be an inappropriate word to use. And I also think that it's incredibly complicated and very confusing to people. And I think all of those things blended together have made an environment that's very challenging for the ordinary person to find and keep a safe and affordable home. My goal or my interest was to demystify, you know, some of these very complicated issues and make it more accessible and understandable to readers, but also to unpack a bit of the policy, you know, that guides decisions made by tenants and landlords that I actually think is really interesting and plays an incredibly important role in hundreds of thousands of people's lives. I mean, like housing instability or having a place to live is one of the most important and stabilizing things that you can have. And it allows you to excel in every other area of your life. So My baseline measure is like, imagine not having a place to live. So imagine trying to find a job, to go to school, when you don't have a place to go home to and take a shower and make your meals. Like, I don't know how you would do that. So I think that's the most important thing we can do is try to make sure that all people who want to live and excel and contribute to the city of Toronto are allowed that stabilizing piece of their lives.
How available is rental housing in Toronto right now?
It's not. So, I mean, our vacancy rate is exceptionally low, almost historically low. I mean, again, landlords can charge whatever they want for empty units. You know, there is a waiting list for subsidized housing that is approximately 96,000 households, a third of which are seniors. So everywhere you look, when you look at housing, you look at incredibly tight vacancy rates, you look at waiting lists, you look at public housing falling apart. Like, we don't have enough housing for people. And whatever we're doing to fix the problem is not happening fast enough.
Can you tell me about 795 College Street?
That's a good one. That one's pretty interesting. So 795 College is this beautiful, older, three-story, you know, brick building on College Street. It starts where this story starts. It was basically home to a community of artists. So these were people who were living in Toronto and enjoying deeply affordable rent on three-bedroom units, sort of in the heart of the city, and that's unheard of.
Yeah.
But what it allowed them to do is to flourish, expand their careers, you know, really invest in the arts and not work four jobs. They house their friends, you know, also obviously threw great parties, raise their kids in the hallways.
Like, it's bohemian.
Yeah, I know. It was beautiful. It was like they created a community. And I mean, the building wasn't perfect. You know, they handled minor repairs themselves, but it actually was a home up until the point where it was purchased by new owners.
Right.
And that's sort of where I come in. So the short version is there's a process that landlords are allowed to use by law that says you can move tenants out if you need to perform substantial renovations on a property. So if someone's living in a rundown unit, you need to gut the kitchen and do the floors. You can say, you know, I can get you out. But the law also says that those tenants are allowed to come back in and have first dibs. So it's the right of first refusal.
Okay.
So in this case, landlord, like the guy buys the building, says, we're going to gut the places. We want you out for renovations. The tenants all say, okay, I can come back in. It's my right. They fill out all the paperwork. But then what the landlords do after the renovations are completed is they moved entirely new tenants in at a much higher rate of rent. And so
what happened to the right of first refusal?
Essentially, the law that says that they have the right of first refusal also says that the new tenants can't be evicted. So it turned into this complicated and baffling process at the landlord and tenant board where the law says landlords can move the old people out. But once they move new people in, those people are legitimate tenants. And so they can't be evicted.
How is this emblematic of the Toronto rental market right now? What is the Toronto rental market like? This is why we have you here.
I would never go as far as to describe it as the Wild West, because I don't think, I mean, there are certainly examples. And I think you and I talked about the recent story in Vice. And I think that's a really good example of, you know, there's lots of madness going on in terms of bidding wars and people giving too much personal information. But the stories that I focus more on when I think about the rental market are policy or law or things that are in place that people either use to protect or abuse relationships between landlords and tenants. So a lot of the things I focus on are, say, the overall pressures on the existing rental stock.
Right.
So I think about things like people in older building in Parkdale. Mm-hmm. So they're, you know, subject to something called an above guideline rent increase, which is one way that landlords can legally apply to raise the rent, again, for major renovations. But for people who are living on intensely fixed incomes, it's an extraordinary pressure, even if it's a small amount. So broader issues related to gentrification. There are no places to live. Like, there's no
right.
places to live. And it's going to cost you way much. It's going to cost you more money than you think.
What does a healthy rental market look like? How is it different from Toronto's? Or how did Toronto's used to be before the vacancy rate got so low?
If I was to imagine what I think a healthy market would look like, it would be a range of housing options that lift people up from the lowest level. And then again, I'm referring to people experiencing homelessness, all the way up to people who are young professionals in the city of Toronto. So I think that our pipeline is deeply broken. I don't think we have enough types of housing to make sure that everyone gets to live in this city.
You guys did some work looking at rental markets across the country.
Uh-huh, we did.
How does Toronto compare? Compared to Vancouver, I assume that it's at least somewhat similar because we've also talked on this podcast about the housing crisis in Vancouver.
Mm-hmm. No, for sure. I think that, and I was brushing up on what our Metro reporters were writing about before I came here. And, you know, where they see a lot of the pressure is sort of in the outer suburbs. But I think what Toronto is seeing is a lot of these areas that are sort of on the edge of the city center. So again, places like Parkdale.
Yeah.
Or sort of wide swaths of the west end of the city. Like, that's where you're seeing rents kind of going through the roof. So I think we're just a bit different when it comes to density, but I think that all prices are rising astronomically across the country.
How did we end up here in Toronto with a rental market this insane? What kind of forces have been at work in the city?
Lots of people want to live here.
Yeah.
I mean, so
first of all, yes.
Yeah. So lots of people want to live here. They want to work here. They want to raise their families here. It's exciting and interesting to be in a big city. And unfortunately, you know, market demand dictates that people will pay to live in a city. I think there's certainly an acknowledgement by all levels of government that, you know, to be a fair and equitable city, that we need to build different types of housing for different types of people.
But have we been doing that?
We're working towards it. So, I mean, you know, we're making steps towards it, and people have made pledges to do it. But we're certainly not building anything that's on pace with demand. And I think that obviously, again, you know, market forces, you know, as, you know, smarter people have said, it's like a landlord can't charge you more unless you're willing to pay for it.
Mm-hmm.
So there's so few units and so many people want to live here that the reality is landlords can probably charge what they want. One of the big issues is empty units. So there is rent control on occupied units.
Okay.
But once a unit is empty, a landlord can charge whatever they want.
It seems there's a huge incentive for landlords to evict tenants then.
Housing experts and activists have certainly pointed to that and said that, you know, there's absolutely a financial incentive for landlords to get people out of older buildings. So if you look in an area like Parkdale, you know, rapidly gentrifying, you know,
right.
really interesting neighborhood. Again, you know, a vibrant community with mixed income. There's artists, great food, you know, increasingly better coffee, which I so appreciate. But I mean, there's lots of tall, beautiful buildings
yeah.
and an easy access to the downtown core. And if you can get people out of those buildings as a landlord, you're going to have no trouble getting people moving back in. So you've got like an immigrant-rich community paying, you know, reasonable rents in older buildings. And if those landlords can get people out, again, like they can jack the rent up $400, clean up the kitchen a little bit, and make a lot more money. when you're already basically like right on the line of poverty, when every cent that you have is going to your TTC pass, to your rent, you know, for books for your kids, any increase in rent basically puts you in a state where you're at risk of losing your housing.
Yeah.
So the idea is that, you know, this is just one thing that can squeeze people out of the places they live.
We just had a provincial election and a municipal election in Toronto.
Sure did.
So how much of a role did rental housing and affordable housing play in those elections, and what kind of promises have been made?
Affordable housing actually became an election issue incredibly quickly, particularly after Jennifer Keesmaat suddenly entered the race.
Right.
Because of the enormous instability that followed when our new premier decided to interfere in the municipal election mid-election. But yeah, so Tory essentially promised to create 40,000 new affordable units in 12 years. Keesmaat was saying she was going to lay out a plan for 100,000 affordable rental units over 10 years. And I mean, we got varying degrees of information on whether those plans were actually going to work. But yeah, I think it became a central issue pretty quickly.
When you talk to activists and people who are working with people who need housing, A, do they feel like that's enough? And B, do they feel like it'll actually happen?
I mean, I think that activists who've on the ground grinding away at this for decades would say that any promises are good news. That we, you know, we've identified that we have a serious issue. You know, it's the top of the discussion around the municipal election. But no, I mean, like, people are actually dying on the streets of Toronto. I mean, like, we have numbers now, which is absurd to me. We didn't have these before, but, you know, 100 people at least died last year on the streets of Toronto because of homelessness. And activists are angry, and I think rightly so. Because, you know, people make these sweeping promises about fixing something. But when it really comes down to it, we are actually, I think it's fair to say, in a crisis. And I don't like throwing that word around, but we're kind of at a bit of a tipping point where whatever we're promising to do isn't going to catch up fast enough to what we actually need. So I think that the promises are a reason to be filled with hope and optimism. But whether they come fast enough to actually, you know, deal with what we're seeing on the ground is an entirely different thing.
Coming up, we will talk to somebody who has been on the ground in Toronto trying to find an apartment for herself, but also talking to a ton of people who have jumped through a ton of hoops to try and find some sort of roof over their heads. We all have investment goals, and Scotia iTrade can help you reach yours. Access free tools and resources to sharpen your investment skills. Visit ScotiaiTrade.com to start direct investing today. Scotia iTrade. There's a trader in all of us. Tamara Kandacker is a reporter at Vice News. Tamara, you've done a ton of work in this area. Give me an example of the kind of things Torontonians do to try to find rental units.
First of all, you have to be able to get a viewing for the apartment, which, believe it or not, has become really difficult. We look for apartments on a bunch of different places. Most people will look at Craigslist, Kijiji, they'll get the help of a realtor, or they'll look at groups like Bunn's Home Zone. And what I've seen through my reporting and through my own experience is that as soon as a posting goes up, the number of responses that it gets is crazy. Sometimes you'll see like 40 to 50 comments within like 20 minutes of the post going up, and then the poster will be like, I'm overwhelmed by messages. I can't really schedule any more viewings, so I'm shutting this posting down. Like, that's it.
And it's gone.
It's gone. You can't even go see the apartment. So that's the first hurdle that you have to overcome. And then there's the things that landlords have been asking for. So like a credit check, being able to pay first and last month's rent.
A damage deposit, maybe?
Well, damage deposits are actually not legal. But,
oh, okay.
But
I didn't know that.
Yeah,
that
they're not allowed.
And I guess references from your previous landlords.
References from your previous landlords. And maybe, and obviously have a face-to-face meeting with the landlord, traditionally.
Right.
But now, landlords have been asking for a lot more things. So the competition has resulted in bidding wars sometimes, where they'll give the apartment to a person who can pay more than what they're asking for. A lot of people have been making profiles of themselves, like written descriptions of themselves, to hand over to landlords to kind of attract their attention and tell them their story and hope that their personality kind of shines through.
Okay.
In that letter, people have also been offering to pay more than first and last month's rent as a deposit. So sometimes they'll offer to pay like up to 6 months' rent. So that's supposed to make them more appealing as a tenant.
You went digging for an apartment yourself. Mm-hmm. What did you find?
Well, I had kind of a hellish couple of months because I was forced out of two apartments, one after the other, because of house fires.
What?
So, yeah.
Okay.
And so I had to find places to live pretty quickly, and it was really, really difficult. I had to I mean, I guess this is what you have to do these days, is you have to have all those things in hand when you go see an apartment. Like, you have to have your landlord reference letter ready. You have to have an employment letter ready. You have to make sure you're able to provide them with a credit check and your first and last month's deposit. So I would have all of that stuff. And then I would go to these viewings, and there would always be a bunch of other people who are also seeing the apartment at the same time. It was never just me. It was never just one or two other people. It would always be like 10 people who were also looking at the same place. And the apartment that I did end up getting, I went in and they were having open houses. They had three separate open houses. And I went to the second one and I had to put my name down on a piece of paper. And there were already about 50 people ahead of me who expressed interest in the apartment after seeing it. So I went back to work. I went to work the next day and I was thinking of how I could set myself apart from these other applicants. So I ended up writing the previous tenants a really long letter explaining my situation to them, that I had been through these house fires and I really needed to find a new place. And
right.
I'm a journalist. I'm 27 years old. And like, I would be this kind of tenant. Please pass this information on to your landlord. And like, I really hope you guys pick me. And that day they emailed me back and they're like, we've decided to go with you because we think that you'd be a good tenant. So that's how I found my place.
Tell me about Nick and Amelia.
So when I first put out the call for stories from people who had crazy experiences while looking for apartments, Amelia was one of the first people who responded, and she told me about her and her partner, Nick. And they'd been looking for an apartment for about 5 months, and they had enlisted the help of, I think, six real estate agents who were all trying to help them find a place. And they were really struggling. They had a budget of $2,000 for a one-bedroom place. And
that doesn't seem unreasonable.
No, it doesn't seem unreasonable. They just couldn't find anything. They made a profile of themselves accompanied by illustrations. Amelia works in animation, so she thought that that would, you know, be something cute to add on and make their written things stand out. They explained who they were. They put in a lot of details about themselves, like the fact that Amelia has asthma, so she would keep the place clean and free of dust. That Nick is from Australia, that he works in publishing and she works in animation. And Nick, because he's not a permanent resident in Canada, he doesn't have any credit. And one of the realtors jokingly said that they should Photoshop his credit score. He was kind of like, yeah, maybe you should do it as a joke, but haha, not really as a joke.
Right.
So they did end up doing that and they Photoshopped his credit score. They also lied and said that they were married because they heard that that would also make them more desirable as tenants. And then they did end up finding a place eventually in Liberty Village, which was $1,800 for a one-bedroom apartment. And the way she describes it is like their living room is the same size as her office receptionist's desk. So there's essentially no living space. But she says that it's still a plus because her landlord doesn't live in the unit, which is what they were dealing with before. So yeah, they did end up finding something, but it was really, really hard.
So what kinds of stuff do you see on the market then when you go out there like on a budget?
You see all kinds of stuff. My apartment, for example, the one that I ended up getting, it needed a lot of work. Like it needed to be cleaned up a lot. It needed new paint everywhere. So I did all of that myself. The landlord wouldn't do it. So that's like one thing that you see. You see places that are just really not maintained well and super dirty and run down. And then you also see people charging just crazy prices. Like I saw this one posting for a shared bedroom, so two beds in one room, and they were charging $1,500 per person.
What?
Yeah.
Wait, so you're paying $3,000 for a room?
Yeah, for a room in a condo at the Shangri-La Hotel, I believe it was.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, it's a nice address.
Yeah.
That's insane.
Yeah.
Tamara Kandacker of Vice News. Earlier, Emily Matthew, affordable housing reporter at the Toronto Star. That was The Big Story, brought to you by Scotia iTrade. You can visit scotiaitrade.com to start direct investing today. And for more from us, you can visit us at thebigstorypodcast.ca. Send us a note, check out some of our other episodes, or hook up with us on social media at Big Story Podcast on Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram. And as always, everywhere you get your podcasts, please hit subscribe, then hit rate, then hit review. Tell us what you think. I am Jordan Heath Rawlings. Thanks for listening. We'll talk tomorrow.